So good evening, everyone. Great to see you all here, and welcome particularly to those who are here for the first time. So this is week three of a Dharma seminar series that I've been calling Difference and Unity, Encountering Injustice on the Bodhisattva Path. And I realize, and you know, say this title each time, but I haven't defined what a bodhisattva is yet. So just in case there's anyone here who doesn't know what a bodhisattva is, don't want to be used too much Buddhist jargon. So in classical Buddhism, a Buddha, a fully realized Buddha, would no longer take reincarnation in the phenomenal world. We're not quite sure where they go, but there's another sort of saying that the Buddha is still out there somewhere, still practicing. You know, like practice never ever ends. But a bodhisattva, bodhi means awakened or awakening, and sattva means being. So a bodhisattva would be a being who doesn't step off that wheel of rebirth and into the phenomenal world, and stays in the world to help other beings awaken. So another way to frame that would be a being who realizes that awakening isn't an individual thing that we accomplished, that our awakening is implicitly of benefit to other to all beings, because we are implicitly not separate from all beings. So this opens up a kind of revelatory or radical, we could say, possibility that every single one of us, to the extent that we open our hearts and mind and let go of rigid defensive ways of being in the world, we are of benefit to others, that it flows outward and backward to, and into us from other beings as well. So this bodhisattva sort of archetype can be really encouraging to us in discouraging times. And, you know, we live in discouraging times. I'm sure, you know, pretty much everyone here has felt discouraged at times in recent months. So we're talking about how we humans perceive difference as threat. You know, the way we divide self and other, me and mine from you and yours, us and ours from them and theirs. How we use these perceptions of difference, consciously and unconsciously, to justify not only harmful behavior, individual behaviors, but unjust political and social structures. All based on, you know, us versus them. So those differences may be based on many different things: gender, sexuality, race, class, ability, appearance, age, even species. And what we've been doing is exploring how Buddhist perspectives and practices can support us to see clearly into the roots of suffering based on these perceptions of difference. And to have that clear seeing help us to respond with open hearts and minds. As I was just trying to finish this talk, looking at it again this morning and thinking about how to fit it into the allotted time span, I realized just really feeling the impossibility of doing any more than scratch the surface on each of these areas. So just beginning to make a space for questions to be asked and conversations to happen within this context of our practice. So I really want to hear back from you about this area, these areas, and if you're interested in going deeper or carrying this, these conversations further in some way, we'll figure out how. You know, maybe a monthly discussion group, workshops, I don't know. But let me know if what your thoughts are and your feelings are. I've been referencing in these talks a core Zen text, a poem from 8th century China called Merging of Difference and Unity, or it's translated different ways, or Identity of Relative and Absolute. And it's about the Buddha's teaching of two truths, the truth of difference, particularity, relativity, the everyday, our everyday lives, is represented by light in the poem. Because in the light, you can see distinctions, right? And then the other truth is the truth of unity, oneness, the absolute. And in the poem, it's represented by darkness. Because in the dark, everything, you can't see distinctions, everything is one. Everything merges. And the whole point of the poem is these truths are simultaneous and interpenetrating. And our practice is to live in both, to live both those truths. So the first week I read the first four lines of the poem, and I want to read you the next four lines. The spiritual source shines clearly in the light, the branching streams flow on in the dark. That's two lines. And that means that even in the light, where we can see the many differences among us, right? Each of you is a totally unique human being. Unity is always there. That generating source of all being is always there, or whatever we want to call it, the universe, you know. And even in the dark, when everything merges and we can't see, the branching streams flow on and differentiate. So there's always both there. Next two lines. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. So what this means, we know that grasping at things that are by nature impermanent is going to cause us suffering. Or at least we learn that if we pay attention. But if we think enlightenment is some kind of blank sameness, you know, that we feel, that we should feel a kind of blank indifference to everything, we're fooling ourselves. That's not it either. So our practice is to develop the capacity to be aware of both truths, to live both truths. So last week we looked at difference and unity through the lens of gender, and we recognize that gender is not so neatly binary as traditional social conventions would have us believe, packed into separate boxes labeled male and female. Many, if not all of us, have at some point in our lives suffered because we felt we did not measure up to society's or our family's expectations of what male and female are supposed to be. And all of us have aspects that are conventionally described as masculine and feminine within us. We talked about gender identity last week, and I just want to clarify something that, you know, whether or not you've ever had questions about your own gender identity, it's virtually impossible in our culture not to have had some suffering around gender roles, gender differences, and expectations. So, you know, it seems like we are learning, maybe, as individuals and as a culture, not only to respect, but to appreciate differing expressions of gender. And I considered lumping sexuality in with gender in the same talk last week, because there's certainly overlap in the discussion, but I decided to devote a separate session to sexuality, sorry, to each, because they're not the same. They're not the same, and sexual orientation does not necessarily correspond to gender identification. And regardless of our sexual orientation, as with gender, few of us could claim that we never suffered over sexuality in our lives. Now, to be truthful, traditional Buddhist teaching doesn't offer us much help, I'm afraid. As with the Judeo-Christian tradition, the body is seen as the seat of passion. Right? And from the male perspective of the scriptures and sutras, the female body is seen as the problem. As we know, the first noble truth taught by the Buddha is that human life is characterized by suffering or dissatisfaction. And the second truth is that the cause of our suffering is desire or craving, desire to get what we want or not to have what we don't want. So desire, you know, is seen as central, as centrally problematic in Buddhism. There's an early Buddhist meditation on impermanence designed to help with non-attachment to sensual desires. I hope it was added later and not designed by the Buddha. I suspect so, because a lot was added on in later years. But clearly this meditation was designed for young male monks. It asks us to imagine beautiful, sensual women, you know, dancing girls in scanty attire, and then to see them aging, their bodies sagging, and then in death, the bodies decaying. It's quite graphic, and I'll spare you the details, but you can look them up. And it's supposed to elicit revulsion. Revulsion. Now, I'm all for contemplating impermanence and decay. Like, I'm not squeamish. I observe road-killed garter snakes and newts on my walks around the block, my country block where I go for, and I take photos of slimy insect-damaged leaves in my fall garden, and I found the faces of the dying to have an incredible, translucent beauty. So I'm okay with contemplating decay and death. But generating loathing for women's aging bodies is not my idea of a wholesome practice. Sorry. Doesn't wash. To me, revulsion is different from non-attachment. And revulsion can spill over into very unwholesome aversion, even hatred and violence. And many of us, not only women but men in our culture, have learned how to hate our bodies. And we don't really need more of that. So I think, you know, we have to use some discernment in looking at traditions that we adopt. And thankfully, the Buddha said, this will all change. Take what I offer, and if you find it wholesome and helpful, use it. And if you don't, don't. The Buddha knew that culture would change and that the rules would change. When it comes to sex, the early texts basically say, if you're a monk or nun, don't think about it, don't do it, period. The wording of the third grave precept about sexuality, the wording has changed over the centuries. In Theravada Buddhism, in the past and the present, for monks and nuns, the precept would simply mean, do not have sexual intercourse. And then there would be further minor precepts, which detail all kinds of other sexual activity not to engage in. Just this morning, I read a review in the most recent Buddha Dharma issue, Buddha Dharma journal, a review of a new book called Sexuality in Classical South Asian Buddhism by a scholar named José Ignacio Cabezón. And the reviewer, named Jeff Wilson, is an American teacher in the Pure Land Buddhist tradition. He comments, "Modern Buddhists, especially those who have only been exposed to the minimal and highly selective Buddhist sutra and commentarial literature available in English, may be bewildered by the views of revered masters of the past who debated endlessly over subjects such as imaginary worms living in women's vaginas, what sexual positions are forbidden, which level of hell one goes to for having engaged in oral sex, and whether or not the Buddha had a real penis." So, we could be fundamentalist Buddhists and say whatever's written down is the word, but Buddhist texts aren't received. They're not prophetically received. They're created by human beings, and so we can situate them in the context of their times and cultures. We don't have to be fundamentalist Buddhists. Attitudes changed somewhat as Buddhism moved into China, despite the patriarchal tradition there. In the Bodhisattva precepts, so these were precepts, it's a shorter list of precepts that stressed the compassionate practice of a Bodhisattva in the world, rather than the letter of the law. And in the Bodhisattva precepts, we find a precept that says, "Do not discriminate between those who come to receive the precepts. A disciple of the Buddha," so that means a Buddhist monk or teacher, "must not discriminate between those who have come to receive the precepts. Everyone must be able to receive them, whether they be a king, prince, minister, government official, bhikshu, bhikkhuni, bhikshuni," that's a monk or nun, "layman, laywoman, a sensuous man or woman, a celestial in one of the 18 realms of Brahma, or a lord of the 6 celestial realms of desire, a person with no sexual organs, a hermaphrodite, eunuch, slave, or any ghost or spirit. No discrimination." So there. And there were Chan masters, Chan is the word for Zen in China, Chinese, who accepted, fully recognized, and empowered their women students. And we find wonderful stories of tough-minded women who challenged the hypocrisy of Zen monks of old. Oh, there's 2 stories I'd really like to tell you. I'm not sure if there's time. Okay. This book, The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. Read them. There's stories in here of named and unnamed powerful women of earlier centuries in not only Zen, but other Buddhist traditions. In our own Soto Zen tradition, because of factors in Japanese history, both men and women can ordain and be married and have a family if they choose. Although, interestingly, in Japan, nuns, who are far fewer, opt not to marry. Because it's harder to have a, you know, like a priest needs a temple wife, and it's harder to have a temple wife if you're a woman in Japan. So it's quite interesting to read, to learn about the lives of nuns in Japan. Many who come to ordaining as nuns later in life, after having been married or raised families. So here in the West, men and women, ordained and lay people, practice together. You know, in the larger centers that offer residential practice, there's not a big difference between the ordained and the lay people. You can come and do full residential practice, whether you're ordained or not, men and women. And the distinctions between monk and layperson are more blurred. As Suzuki Roshi, who founded our lineage in the West, once quipped, "You're all kind of in between." And this makes for some interesting challenges in terms of intensive residential practice, because there's an intensity to full-time spiritual practice, and that when that syncs up with the intensity of sexual energy, there's a need for it to handle that with care. And so practice centers have guidelines and rules that residents agree to follow when they enter into full-time practice, such as agreeing not to initiate a new relationship during a practice period, to wait a certain amount of time. You know, if there's someone that you're feeling attracted to, you wait. Well, since when do we do that in our culture? In earlier times, there would be that, you know, kind of courtship time or waiting time, and it's maybe something that we could do well to learn from. So there's that, and also if someone decides to ordain, often the teacher will say, ask for a commitment not to start a new relationship for a period of time after ordaining, because full-time practice takes a lot of time and energy, and so does developing a new relationship. So if you're a layperson, the traditional admonitions would have been simply to be a good husband or wife and don't engage in abnormal sexual activities. Now we find the wording in our chant book of that precept is not to misuse sexuality, but to maintain integrity in personal relationships. Or another wording is to be caring and faithful in intimate relationships. So when people formally receive the precepts and do a study group with us, we say, with each precept, put this in your own words. How would you put this into words that are meaningful to you? How do we do that? What does it mean to maintain integrity in personal relationships? Religions have been trying to get humans to behave sexually for millennia, using fear and guilt and shame, and commandments and admonitions. Hasn't worked very well, has it? Sexual energy is a powerful force, and the human need for affection and connection is fundamental. On the mammalian spectrum, our pair bonding pattern is relatively strong, but our monogamous behavior is overall rather weak. And the ways we express our sexuality and with whom is much more variable than what social norms until very recently have accepted. People whose sexuality does not conform to the heterosexual norm have been stigmatized, persecuted, imprisoned, killed. Even now, this is a life-threatening reality in many parts of the world, and sometimes still right here in our own backyard. Even though the word queer is in common, becoming more and more common usage these days, I still don't feel at ease using it unless I'm sure that is the word that the person I am engaging with is comfortable or using to identify themselves. When I was just a small child, I to this day, can hear the voice of a neighborhood kid screaming at another kid. And I didn't even know what it meant. He may not even have known what it meant. But the hatred and venom in his voice was clear and chilling, and it left an indelible imprint on my memory. We will encounter difference in sexuality in our intimate relationships, in our friendships, and in our society because each of us has a particular physical, emotional makeup conditioned by our past experience, family, society. And sexuality is an inextricable part of human life, which we all share. I think it's helpful to consider where sexuality and other kinds of difference intersect. The most immediate intersection being gender. Intersection is point of connection, right? So sexuality and gender intersect in terms of conditioning, power differential, so many different ways. You know, I just as we were driving in on the news was that doctor who for decades sexually abused girls and young women on the American gymnastic team. Tens, if not hundreds, of them. And no one intervened. No one intervened. So there's an intersection of sexuality and gender. And we have to see it really clearly. We have to feel the pain of that. And then let's also think about race, age, appearance, physical and mental disability, and the way those factors distort how we behold each other as sexual beings. Consider how being gay or queer and also a racial or religious minority can be double or triple jeopardy. Did you see the film Moonlight? Yeah. You know, there are more and more writers and filmmakers and dancers and poets telling us. Or when someone is physically or mentally disabled, or when we grow old, particularly women as we grow old, how we're no longer seen as sexual beings. Is there a way to see and honor each other as sexual beings that is independent of the objectifying lens of our own desires and needs? Just that beholding with appreciation. So, the word intersectionality, I probably heard that word flying around. It's become a bit of a buzzword, sounds kind of academic. But I'd like us to think about that word and use it not just to sound good and not just to describe those points of intersection where oppression is amplified, though we need to do that, we need to see that. But also let's use it to think about and help us see those points of intersection by which we can open our hearts and minds to each other across difference, you know? Because there's all those intersections, you know? If we were to draw little lines right here, even in this room, we'd find those points of intersection. I think that we, and by we, I don't mean just Buddhists, but secular humanists, Christians, Jews, Muslims, First Nations, many others who want to live in a humane and just world, are creating an ethics of sexuality based not on fear and shame. Because it doesn't work. It just hurts more. But based on respect and kindness. Honoring the body as our earthly home. Our vehicle, the vehicle for our love and awakening. I'm going to go out on a limb here and venture to say that if we can truly love our bodies in their tender particularity and give that love to our intimate partners and respect to others, that we may even be better equipped to let go when the time comes, knowing we have loved well. Better equipped than if we're still in the grip of guilt, shame, and loathing. Zenju Earthland Manual, who wrote this book, calls it the way of tenderness. She's a black lesbian American Zen teacher in our Soto lineage. And she says, the way of tenderness is an experiential, non-intellectual, heartfelt acknowledgement of all embodied difference. It is a flexibility of perception rather than a settling into belief. So this is the spirit in which I invite you all and us to continue these explorations in our community of practice. Now, the last couple of weeks, I gave you sort of focus question to consider and asked you to write some things down. I asked you to think about your first awareness of injustice, you know, growing up. And I asked you last week to think about what messages you received from family, culture, growing up around gender, and how that shaped you, and maybe how that hurt you. How you saw that as a source of suffering, or how you experienced the difference in terms of gender. And so this week, I'm not going to ask you to write, and then we got in a circle, and we did a talking circles around that. This week, I'm not going to ask you to stop and write it down, because there's not time anyway. Sexuality is such a vulnerable place that, you know, I'm not going to ask you, but you might want to, if you have appreciated doing these writing exercises, you might want to take that home and do that to think, okay, what were my earliest experiences, conditioning, messages around sexuality and difference? And because we must, the whole message, I think, of all of this is that I want to communicate is that we must know ourselves and we must know our own conditioning and our own suffering if we are to open our hearts to others and see the common roots of our suffering. So feel free to take that home as an exercise. Right now, I think what we'll do, I wanted to comment, once our teacher Norman Fisher, who has been coming up here for 30 years, in earlier years, sometimes he would come up early on a Friday and we'd do a Friday workshop, which would be on a theme like communication or, Zen, practice in the workplace or this or that. We had a number of different themes. We tried one on sexuality one time, and it was the worst attended of all of them. You know, usually these were pretty well attended. And so it's hard, it's hard to talk about. It's hard to talk about. So all I want to do is we'll make two circles like we did. Michael, people on that end, make a circle with Michael. People on this end, come and make a circle here. And we'll just go around and each person just briefly share anything, just some reflection that comes up for you having, from the talk, from your own experience. Only just what you would feel comfortable sharing and briefly.